Chapter 31. The wood had called to Davin again, a cast-off branch of an elder pine. He whittled at it unconsciously, even though it was the most fragile creation he had attempted, a delicate stalk of columbine flowers. These would go to the cross Mr. Goodwin, who huddled in the fold of an elder oak, unable to sleep. The dead of night in an elder forest filled the senses. With the swallowing dark close about them, Davin's sense of smell and hearing reached out farther than his eyes could have seen in the wood. The familiar din of night in the forest felt like a second home to him. The soft scrape and tremble of leaves, the sweet smell of rot, the scrabble of beetles against the hard bark, the primal call of the emperor loons, haunting and otherworldly. All friends to him, soothing and easily ignored. To Mr. Goodwin and Mr. Page, the royal wood was a den of terror. Perhaps they had the right of it. Davin realized he had rarely felt this comfortable at night in the wild. Perhaps the cowardly company with whom he shared a cold camp boosted his confidence by virtue of comparison. Somewhere in the dark to the west, a group of at least 10 men searched for them, men intent on sending Mr. Page and anyone connected to him to their deaths. Add to this saber cats, dire wolves, and terror birds, and their precarious circumstances certainly warranted the hunted and haunted looks of his companions. After fleeing the wrecked carriage, they raced into the forest, if the halting pace of Mr. Goodwin and Mr. Page could be called racing. He had sent the two reluctant men ahead, waiting near the forest edge to see who was coming down the road after them. Like a herd, the posse swarmed over the hill and raced to the carriage. As he had hoped, the unsavory lot stopped to stuff their pockets with the scattered money from the barrel. This distraction bought time. It also brought the concealing dark closer. A 3-day journey on foot through the forest would bring them to Hightower and help. With his two enfeebled companions, he feared the journey might stretch much longer. Mr. Goodwin was old. Mr. Page was an injured voluptuary, and Davin figured that if he counted the steps the corpulent man had taken in the last 10 years, the distance probably wouldn't add up to a mile. Just getting to the forest had nearly killed Mr. Page, and only the promise of a bullet to his head motivated him to keep hoofing it onward. A soft rustling to the south broke into the night. Mr. Page sat bolt upright.
"What was that?"
Davin stopped carving for a moment. "There was a sloth adjusting its position ever so slightly on a tree branch about 10 yards from here."
"Will it eat us?"
Davin sighed. Justice had asked this question 3 times. "No, sloths eat plants, and they are probably the only creatures in the wood that you could outstrip in a race. Now keep quiet or you'll attract more than just animals, Mr. Page."
"Like what?"
he whimpered. "Such as the men intent on murdering us all. Keep still." Davin continued his blind carving, feeling the delicate edge of the downward-bending columbine bell with its flaring petals. The sure, supple strokes of the blade emptied his mind, allowing him to focus. Ariane kept finding her way into his thoughts, setting his heart to hammering. He knew now the difference between Emile's flattery and genuine affection. How he longed to see the Lady of Hightower again, to find her safe and warm and smiling in her drawing room at Hightower. Nearly 4 days had passed since he had left her side. To think of her in a dungeon or in a callous court or in danger horrified him. Beneath the ancient trees and with coarse company, he found that he missed her. And in the dark, the rough bark of the tree against his back, he realized he couldn't bear the thought of her in any man's embrace but his. But his dignity and honour would not let him sully her name by connecting it with his. The two contrary desires strove within him, wearying his mind. He set the knife back in its bag. The carving was complete. With careful fingers, he traced its outline, marvelling at the smooth wood running along the tip of his finger. Even a master could not cut a shape so finely with a tool as crude as his knife. Mr. Goodwin stirred and stumbled through the darkness, his shuffling sore feet working up a racket in the dried leaves on the ground. He cursed as he approached. The scant beams of moonlight breaking through the canopy of leaves was hardly enough illumination for his old eyes. Davin spoke, voice low. "Are you well, Mr. Goodwin?"
"Of course not. My knees feel like a big, stupid blacksmith who's been hammering at them with Justice Page's head. I won't even mention what's plaguing my backside. I noticed you stopped your insufferable carving. What did you make?"
Davin handed it to him. Mr. Goodwin held it up at various angles, but settled for exploring it with his fingers, as Davin had done. Mr. Goodwin grumbled about the dark.
"What is it? It feels like a plant."
"It is a columbine flower. It's yours." Mr. Goodwin stood silent for a while, and when he finally spoke, his voice carried a wistful note.
"How did you know?"
"Know what, Mr. Goodwin?"
"That girl I told Justice Page about. The last flower I purchased from her was a white columbine. I keep it pressed in a book in my jacket. She really was a lovely girl."
"Then I hope the carving reminds you of her," Davin said. "I'm sorry for your loss." Mr. Goodwin grunted, stifling some emotion.
"Is this the gift the Eternal Flame gave you? To carve?"
Davin brushed the wood shavings off of his legs. "It is. It is an odd gift, to be sure."
"And a fairly useless one,"
Mr. Goodwin added, "though I thank you just the same." "And what is your gift?" Davin asked.
"It's a curse, really. Don't laugh too heartily at my expense, but my gift is apparently long life."
"It is a good gift." Mr. Goodwin didn't reply. Justice Page had finally fallen asleep, but to Davin's chagrin he snored like a short-faced bear after gorging itself for hibernation. Mr. Goodwin snorted.
"I believe that fiend over there knows more about this plot than he let on in our little session under the brawny maid."
Davin nodded. "My thought as well. He exists to grant favours and exert leverage. He wouldn't be content with simply funneling money to and from important people without discovering more that he could use to his advantage. If nobles are involved, that knowledge could fetch a high price, or save him from execution." A slight change in the light brought Davin to his feet. His eyes could barely perceive the slight difference in illumination, but a flickering orange hue tinged the broad leaves just ahead. Someone had lit a fire just to the southeast.
"What is it?"
Mr. Goodwin asked.
"A fire."
"Not far."
"We must stay very quiet now. We may need to move."
Davin grabbed his rifle and ammunition back. The only advantage they had in their flight from the posse on their heels was stealth and ease of movement through the more tangled avenues of the forest. Their pursuers had horses. While they couldn't ride them at speed through the trackless wood, their mounts spared them the rigours of the chase. The rigours of the chase were not sparing Mr. Goodwin and Mr. Page. Fortunately, it appeared that not one of their pursuers had enough skill to track a mammoth through a field of corn. The direction of the faint firelight indicated that the posse had nearly flanked them. The cold had apparently gotten the better of their need for stealth. If he could remove the advantage of their horses, they stood a much greater chance of escaping the royal wood alive. He would wait an hour or two until they slept or were lulled into a sense of security, and then see what he could do. He whispered the plan to Mr. Goodwin, who nodded in agreement and then adjusted the corpse like Mr. Page until his snoring was extinguished. Before long, Mr. Goodwin's exhaustion finally dulled his discomfort enough to let him sleep, the columbine carving affixed in the buttonhole of his lapel. Davin woke him a couple hours later before he left, indicating he and Mr. Page should be at the ready to move. The illumination he had sensed earlier had weakened during the last half hour. They no longer tended the fire. Rifle in hand and ammunition pouch at his hip, he stole into the dark, amazed at how well he could see. Even then, a silent approach would require every skill he'd ever mastered tracking prey in the forests around Frostborn. Dry sticks and crisp brown leaves spread out around him like alarm bells, begging for a careless foot to ring them. Of all the skills of the hunter, patience was the hardest to master, and he needed it now. Slow, steady. The fire and the men encamped around it waited a scant half mile away. At his cautious pace, he started to worry that dawn might overtake him. He risked increasing his pace, paying the price in noise. As he neared the camp, the smell of wood smoke strengthened, and he again slowed to the pace of a sloth. By the time he got close enough to see it, the fire had faded to brightly glowing coals and thin tendrils of smoke, and then he observed what he had hoped. The main body of men had camped 20 yards from where they had staked up the horses. He crept forward. He could see no guard, but if they had one lick of sense among them, someone would be on watch, perhaps behind the trunk of a tree or hidden in the underbrush. A waft of mint filled his nose and he stopped still. It was pale mint,
a white ground cover that grew at the edge of the permafrost in the north. He would bring it home after some of his excursions and boil it to fill the house with the pleasant smell, a smell that had no place in the warmer climes of a bitter Marchian forest. Had the posse brought some? It seemed unlikely. He pushed the oddity out of his mind and focused back on the horses. If he could lift the stakes out of the ground, an unexpected gunshot in the night would send the mounts bolting every which way. He could easily escape in the confusion. Rather than press on through the wood, he could take Mr. Goodwin and Mr. Page, double back to the road and make for Brighton. He might even find one of the scattered horses and put it to use. He crouched. There had to be a guard. He would wait and watch a little while longer for him to reveal himself. The odour of pale mint again teased his nose. Where was it coming from? A sharp point jabbed into the nape of his neck.
Stay still.
The barely audible voice was that of a woman, strangely accented.
Hand your rifle back slowly.
He hesitated and the point shifted, a sharp edge sliding along the side of his neck. It felt jagged.
Now, brown man.
He lifted the rifle and handed it back, someone grabbing it. Whoever it was, she was quiet. The spear tip lifted from his neck.
Now turn, she instructed him. Slowly and quietly, or we will all die.
Davin complied, twisting and standing to face the strangers in the darkness. Two women stood on the wide root of the tree near where he had waited, and the smell of mint emanated from them both. North people. The Aua Catan, ice miners in the northernmost extents of the Icefire Mountains, brought stories about the elusive Aua Catan to Bittermarch, though sightings of the strange tribal folk were rare. The women before him were tall, almost as tall as he was, and in the dark he couldn't tell the two of them apart. Snow-white hair flowed down around slender shoulders. They were clad in soft hides, wearing long breeches that hugged their lithe forms. Their leather shirts were open 2 inches down the middle of their chests, crisscrossed with leather ties. Ice-blue eyes regarded him warily, their quartz spears at the ready.
Now, brown man, one of them said, we see you have some skill. Come quietly into the fold of the tree with us, if you value your life.
Davin thought of bolting, but if the two mysterious Aua Catan had wanted him killed, they would have done so already. He was dangerously close to the camp. Starting a racket would bring 10 armed men down upon them. He stepped onto the wide route that allowed the two women and their leather boots to tread so quietly. They pulled him into a large fold of the tree, forcing him in between them and standing shoulder to shoulder.
Now, hold very still, the one to his right instructed. You smell of blood and sweat, which will attract them. Our scent will mask yours.
Davin shifted uncomfortably.
Attract what? The birds, brown man. Wait.
The two Aua Catan women stood as silently and still as rocks, and even in close quarters, Davin couldn't so much as hear them breathe. What he could hear just minutes later was a scraping and fluttering coming closer. The terror birds preferred the deep forests to the south, and in all his excursions in Frostborne, he had never crossed one. He wondered how the women had known they would come their direction. By the racket the birds were making, he guessed that 4 of the enormous, bipedal animals were passing nearby. From hunter lore, he knew the terror birds could stand taller than a man and had hooked beaks for ripping flesh. Their taloned feet walked slowly in a predatory stalk, just as he had but moments earlier, but the horse's sense of smell alerted them to their danger. Nervous whinnies and stamping broke into the night, and at that instant, the terror birds shot forward with a long, shrill scream that froze Davin's heart. Terror, indeed. The murderous, hunting calls echoed like screams of wrath from the blackest of hearts, rousing the somnolent woods with the shrieks of horses and curses of men. Davin imagined a fresh puddle of urine at Mr. Page's feet. His captors kept their stoic vigil. He had to fight his beating heart. Loose horses ran in every direction, hooves pounding through the night, while some of their companions wailed their last. Gunshots rang out, men howled in agony, and others joined the horses in retreat into the forested blackness. And they waited. Wet, sloppy sounds of meat and gore pulled from bone and belly were their only companions for nearly an hour. At length the birds finally moved off, and the women ordered him out. Campfire gone, only the scant moonlight provided illumination. One of the women dug packs out of an adjacent fold of the tree, fumbling inside until she produced a small chunk of fungus that glowed blue, casting enough light to walk by. Davon had never seen its like. She brought the glowing mass toward him and the other woman.
"Read him, Kianla, quickly."
Kianla lowered her spear and walked forward, standing toe to toe with him. In the blue light he could see a tattoo on her cheek and more along her arms. Her eyes drilled into his and then she closed them, bringing up her hand. The thumb and two adjacent fingers stretched long and the other two bent down. Her palm bore the mark of a leaf, not a tattoo, but a scar, like the flames on his palms. Expunging the breath from her chest with a prolonged exhale, she turned the palm toward her face and touched her forehead, and then reversed it, placing it on his chest over the heart. The sharp smell of pale mint flooded him as her face nearly touched his. He breathed out and she breathed in, as if sucking in the air from his lungs. For a moment her face registered nothing, and then she smiled, eyes flicking open. She stepped back. Kianla turned her eyes to the woman behind him.
"It is as I told you, Ta. His heart is good. There is love and honor in his wind."
"What is his war?" Ta'anla asked.
"Loneliness," Kianla responded.
"Please," Davon said, stepping forward. Kianla's spear point dropped to his heart and he raised his hands. The woman's mouth dropped, as did her spear. She darted forward and took his hand, examining his palm.
"Come, Ta, bring the light. What is it, Ki? We must press on. The birds may return for more carrion. Look, the brown man is flame-touched."
With both women in front of him gawking at his palms, he knew the reason he couldn't tell them apart in the dark. He couldn't tell them apart in the light. Every last detail of their appearance was the same, down to the length of hair and the placement of their blue ink tattoos. A length of strange characters ran scandalously down the center of their chests and abdomens. They turned their gaze upon him. One of them, Ta, he thought, spoke.
"We captured the sentry of the lot sleeping around the fire. Key's reading of him did not go so well as yours. Take us to your companions, brown man."
"My name is Davon," he said.
The other grabbed his arm.
"A very dull name. Let's go."
Apparently his flame-touched status did not help them trust him. They lowered their spears in his direction and prodded him on without further talk. The blue light provided just enough illumination to negotiate the forest directly at his feet, but no more. He wondered where to acquire some. Mr. Page's sobs directed them toward their camp, quickly followed by a terrified intake of breath.
"A ghost! A spirit!" he exclaimed.
"It's me," Davon said.
"Be calm, Mr. Page."
Mr. Goodwin stepped out from behind the concealment of the tree.
"What in the dreadful name of everything horrible did you do, Lord Carver? I have never heard such an awful—"
And he saw them, and his mouth fell. Mr. Page stuck his head around the trunk next, puffy eyes shooting wide. He shrunk back.
"Savages!"